this is Deborah Kelso, host of this edition for Nature Now for mid-December. This week, we are very pleased to have for you part two of our interview with Dr. Kirk Johnson, SANT Director of the Smithsonian Institute's National Museum of Natural History. Hopefully, many of you will have made it to his wonderful and standing room only lecture last month with artist Ray Troll, who were both here to speak at Fort Worden about their recent book, Cruise in the Fossil Coastline. He was in transit from Washington, D.C. to our fair city at the time that we spoke with him, but he was able to join us by telephone. Before we get to our main topic, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. You may think that you know this one, but it can sometimes be tricky to identify. We'll play it again at the end of the program and tell you what it is. Our friend and neighbor Jeff Hammerson sent us one of his wonderful photo essays this week, summarizing the highlights of the week. After a quiet early fall, recent cooling temperatures have been associated with large numbers of deer mice, including adults and juveniles, trying to relocate into the heated trailer. And they've caught 12 mice in the past 2 weeks. I myself noticed a boom in the deer mouse population earlier this summer and recently had to have a giant nest taken out of the heating ducts in my car.
Oh, dear.
I know, it was bad.
Many, and I mean many, new molehills have been appearing as moles dig deeper, presumably to access warmer sites for their nests. Flocks of shorebirds, dunlins, black turnstones, sanderlings, black-bellied plovers, killdeer, black oyster catchers, and a few surf birds are foraging and roosting along local shores.
Lots of mergansers, which include red-breasted, common, and hooded, are in local coastal waters, along with a wide assortment of other diving water birds, which include scaup, buffleheads, common and barrow's golden eyes, surf scoters, harlequin ducks, red-necked and horned grebes, common loons, rhinoceros auklets, pigeon guillemots, and marbled murrelets. Inland, Anna's hummingbird males have been displaying, and you can see their steep dives with a loud squeak at the bottom.
Jeff has gotten some very interesting information from a motion detection camera that he set up at a home, which has made me long for one of my own.
Me too.
He got a great image of a couple of ravens picking up dead mice from traps in the trailer and flying away with them. One packed its throat and bill with three mice before departing.
Coyotes have been very active of late in our woods west of Port Townsend, and Jeff recorded a couple of them eating dead mice that were deposited in front of the camera. He placed a dead coast mole that he found dead on the road in front of the camera also, but this was not eaten. One coyote repeatedly rubbed its face and neck and rolled on it, but did not eat it. I've often wondered what it is about moles that makes them so unpalatable. They're usually found dead on the surface of the ground without a mark on them, and they only disappear with the action of decomposing beetles.
Pacific tree frogs, aka chorus frogs, have been calling in the forest and along roadsides whenever the air temperature exceeds about 40 to 45 degrees Fahrenheit. The shortest day and longest night of the year is coming up on Saturday, December 21st. In astronomy, the winter solstice is a moment when the Earth is at a point in its orbit where one hemisphere is most inclined away from the sun, and this will happen at 8:19 p.m. this year in Seattle. For our practical purposes, what it means is that our day length is about 8.5 hours right now, about 7.5 hours shorter than at summer solstice on June 21st.
Isn't that incredible?
If you can believe
that.
The good news is that our days will start to get longer on December 23rd. Hooray for the return of the sun.
Yay, yay, yay. Last month, we ran out of time while speaking about paleontology and much more with Dr. Kirk Johnson. We are now very pleased to take up part two of that conversation. So, for a place that's so fossil rich, I was amazed to learn that there have been no dinosaur fossils found in Washington until 2014. Why is that, And would you please tell us the story of the Washington Fossil Challenge?
Well, it's funny. There was about, I think, 35 or so of the states that produced dinosaur fossils. And in order to find a dinosaur fossil, you have to have rocks that were deposited as sediments during the time of dinosaurs. That is to say, you have to have rocks that are younger than about 230 million years old and older than 66 million years old. And those rocks have to be exposed at the surface, and you have to walk along and find a dinosaur bone sticking out. And Washington State does have quite a few rocks that are of that time period. Well, not a lot, but there are definitely places that have rocks of that time period. And no one had ever found a dinosaur. So I gave a talk, I think, in 2014 at Meany Hall in University of Washington. And I was all wound up because I was like, you know, Washington should have a dinosaur. I mean, it really should. I mean, there are enough rocks here that somebody should find a dinosaur here. And after the talk, so I challenge everybody, especially the geologists at the University of Washington, I said, you guys got to go out and find Washington dinosaur.
They were shamed into it.
But then after the talk, one of them came up to me and said, actually, we just found it. We haven't published it yet. It's going to come out shortly. So I was like, oh, sweet. My answer is, you know, my wish has been answered immediately. And what they'd done is up in the San Juan Islands, the northern half of the San Juan Islands have rocks that are Cretaceous in age. It is about 80 million year old rocks. And they're mainly marine rocks. That is to say that they were deposited as sediments underneath the salty sea. So the kinds of fossils you find in those rocks are clams and snails and oysters and crustacea and marine reptiles, the kinds of things that lived in the Cretaceous Sea. So you wouldn't necessarily expect to find a dinosaur out in the sea, but it turns out, and this has happened many times around the world, that dinosaurs died, they floated out to sea and then sank to the bottom. So you have an animal that lived on land, but somehow its carcass washed out to sea and then they sank to the bottom. And that's what they found. A guy named Jim Gettert, who was a amateur fossil guy who's collected so many fossils, he's almost like a professional. He's published about 100 scientific papers. Found this bone on Sushi Island in the, the northernmost San Juan Islands. And he didn't think much of it because it looked like it was just a chunk of bone. You couldn't see the edges. But next time he went there, he found another piece of it and he put them together. He's like, oh, there is enough of a bone to collect. So he collected the bone. The guys from the University of Washington went up and helped collect. But once they saw the bone, they realized it was the leg bone of a dinosaur that was very similar to Tyrannosaurus rex. So how lucky is that, that your first and only dinosaur is a relative of Tyrannosaurus rex, the most famous of all dinosaurs? So Washington did really well. And we call it a bloat and float dinosaur because the animal died, it bloated with gases and floated out into the ocean and then sank to the bottom. So it's a bloat and float Tyrannosaur is Washington's first and so far only dinosaur.
Huh. Well, cool. Is it at the Burke? Where can people go see it?
Yeah, it is at the Burke. But, you know, the Burke has just reopened. They opened on October 12th. And the Burke has been doing a field program out in northeastern Montana. And they discovered a couple of years ago one of the most perfect Tyrannosaurus rex skeletons ever found. Not the skeleton, but they found just the skull. And the skull is nearly perfect.
Wow.
It's the real treasure of the Burke Museum that they've only had for a few years. It's a great museum.
It is a great museum. And we're blessed here on the Olympic Peninsula to be in a zone where some very cool fossils have been found. Would you please give us a brief summary of what these have been and where they've been found?
There are lots. I mean, the Olympic Peninsula has got a lot of vegetation that rains so much. So most of the rocks are covered. But if you are on the beaches or on the river cuts or in the sometimes on road cuts, you get exposures of rocks, and almost all the Olympic Peninsula rocks were deposited as sediments under the sea. So most of your Olympic Peninsula fossils are going to be marine fossils, things like crabs and snails and fish bones, and some of the bones of the earliest marine mammals. So marine mammals include things like the seals and sea lions and walruses, but also the whales and porpoises and dolphins. And then even some more obscure groups. There's a group of marine mammals that appeared around 25 million years ago, went extinct around 11 million years ago, called the Desmostylids. And they were sort of these hippo-like beasts, traits of Juan de Fuca. So there's a pretty amazing host of marine organisms that are more or less, I'd say, like 10 to 30 or 40 million years old that record the history of evolution of marine life during the time after the dinosaurs were alive. And then sitting on top of that is the debris from the ice ages. Those great big ice sheets had lots of sediment. There are both mammoths and mastodons known from the Olympic Peninsula. And a famous one was found near Squim called the Manus mastodon. It was found by a guy named Manny Manus, who was digging a pond in his yard. And he, in the bottom of the pond, he encountered the skeleton of a mastodon. And later, it was shown that the mastodon actually had a spear point embedded in one of its bones. So it was a mastodon that had been harvested and barbecued near Squim, I think like 12,000 years ago. First evidence of a giant barbecue on the Olympic Peninsula that I'm aware of.
I remember reading that in your book. It made it one of the earliest evidence for people in North America, right? By finding that bone projectile sticking out of the rib.
That's right. And then, but since that time, there have been several sites that are older than that. So like, science is always moving on. And for the humans in North America, we're always looking for the oldest one. But each time you find the oldest one, there might be an older one even still. And as a result, we're not actually sure when the first humans got to North America. We know that it was at least 16,000 years ago. It might be as much as 24,000 years ago, and it might even be older than that. So there's lots of ongoing debate because the evidence of the early humans is pretty rare and hard to find. And then when you find it and you date it, you're like, okay, we've got humans here, let's say at Squim and 12,000 years ago, and now we've got humans in Idaho at 16,000 years ago. And slowly we add these new discoveries and we build up the story of when did people actually get to North America.
But that makes it really exciting is that you're always building on past information and you never know when you might get more, or there might be a tool developed to age it in a more specific manner.
Yeah, no, that's the great thing. You just know there's going to be more discoveries. That's what I love about science and paleontology specifically, is that just wait a little bit and some amazing thing is going to happen. It's really cool.
It is. I mean,
just today, for instance, there was a publication that came out that showed this incredible dinosaur feathers from Australia. So we now know that birds and dinosaurs are close relatives, and one of the ramifications of that is that many of the dinosaurs should have had feathers. But since most dinosaur sites don't preserve the skin or the feathers, you don't know which dinosaurs had feathers and which didn't. But this really cool site in Australia had just the most exquisitely beautiful dinosaur feather preserved.
Oh.
And so what you think dinosaurs look like is changing. And people like Ray, who paint dinosaurs, are continually having to change their paintings because they're learning more and more about what dinosaurs actually look like.
Like the salmon that he had to tweak his painting of the salmon to be the spike. What is the final name for that ancient salmon?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was, so we had the saber-toothed salmon, which is a great name, but then it turned out that the tusks didn't face down like sabers. They faced straight out like spikes. So he calls it the spike-toothed salmon. They're big fish. They're up to 10 feet long.
I was astonished to read that in the book, to see the illustration and read about the story of how that drawing evolved as you acquired more information and how huge those fish were. Wasn't it like 500 pounds and like 8 feet long? It was just some astonishing size and weight.
Yeah, and you thought the Elwha had big salmon.
That's
right.
They're
a monster.
I know. Well, and we haven't even talked about the cool plants. I mean, there are those palm fronds and the other gorgeous giant leaf fossils found near Chuckanut, right, on the way to Bellingham?
Yeah, that mountain south of Bellingham is made up of rocks that are about 55 million years old, and they're chock-a-block full of fossil plants. In fact, on the plane flying in this morning, I was making an illustration I'm going to show when I'm in Port Townsend of the leaves, because most people don't think about fossil leaves, but if you think about fossil leaves, they can really tell you what a place looked like. They can tell you what the forest looked like. And you know what the forest around Port Townsend and Bellingham looks like today? It's mainly a conifer forest with some small broadleaf plants. But when those rocks were being deposited on Chuckanut Drive, the landscape here was subtropical and it was a rainforest. So it looked more like Costa Rica than British Columbia. And I was going through the photographs, the images, going, yeah, these leaves, if you can read leaves, you can see ancient worlds. And the leaves tell you this incredible story about the subtropical rainforest of Washington State.
it's wonderful that they preserved so well, too. I mean, the photos that you have of the fossils are just gorgeous.
You wouldn't think a leaf would make a good fossil, but the fact is, if a leaf drops in the mud, it makes like a little print, and those prints are pretty permanent. So we have fossil leaves that go back as long as there have been trees, which is about 400 million years.
Wow. Is that beautiful sandstone wall that you described covered with fossil palm fronds still there to see along Chuckanut Drive?
Oh, yeah. No, it's there are several places like that on Chuckanut Drive. The main thing is that people are driving there, so you got to be really careful because people come zooming by in their cars. If you're standing there looking at a rock wall, you could be a fossil yourself if you're not careful.
Yeah, well.
So that's the main thing I would urge people to do is, you know, stop and see these things, but be super careful about your human safety because no one wants to go extinct in their own time.
No. Apparently, there have also been some wonderful ammonites found on the east side of Vancouver Island. How does their story help us reconstruct the history of the Pacific Coast?
So Vancouver Island is a part of a landmass geologists call Wrangellia, and it basically is a chunk, a little sliver of a different continent that floated into place or was rafted into place. So Vancouver Island is not of North America. It came off the Pacific Ocean and was smashed into the side of North America. And the West Coast has been getting wider by the arrival of these long ribbon continents and island masses that get slammed onto and accreted to the continent. So I always look at Vancouver Island and the Olympic Peninsula as two cars parked up against the curb, with North America being the curb and Vancouver Island being one car and the Olympic Peninsula being another car. You know, I'm sitting here parked in my car right now and I'm looking at a truck in front of me. That would be the Vancouver Island vehicle. I'm in the Olympic Peninsula vehicle. And as a result, the fossils that you find on Vancouver Island have one of two stories. Either they were living and died when Vancouver Island was a long ways away from here, or they were living and died after Vancouver Island had docked against North America. And it looks like those marine ammonites are kind of distant relatives of chambered nautiluses, were living on or near Vancouver Island in the water around Vancouver Island when Vancouver Island itself wasn't on or near North America. So it's a pretty amazingly elaborate, cool story that, again, is one of these stories that's just evolved in the last 25 or 30 years as we realize that big chunks of Western North America didn't start out where they are now.
So ammonites went extinct about the same time as dinosaurs did, right?
It turns out they went extinct almost exactly the same time because they had the same cause of extinction. They were both snuffed out by the after effects of this gigantic asteroid that struck the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico about 66.02 million years ago. And it was such a big asteroid impact that it affected both animals and plants on land and animals and plants in the sea. And ammonites are in the sea, dinosaurs on the land. They both had a very bad day.
I'd say so. That's one of your specialties, isn't it? The KT boundary between the Cretaceous and what used to be the tertiary.
Yeah, now they call it the Cretaceous Paleogene boundary. Some people will say KPG boundary or KT boundary or just a massive asteroid impact. I mean, it doesn't really matter what you call it. We just know it ended the Cretaceous period. It really was one of the most impressive events in all of Earth history. It's the only thing we know about in all of Earth's history that was instant and global. It was an instant global catastrophe. So they'd never had an asteroid big enough when there was life around to feel the wrath of a major asteroid impact. And so it sits out there as an example of something we definitely do not want to have happen again.
No, but there's not much we could do about it, is there?
There's lots of discussion. If we saw an asteroid out there and we had some time, would we be able to mount a defense? And there's definitely a lot of discussion about that at NASA because these things are out there and there are a variety of asteroids and comets that have Earth-crossing orbits. And it's just a matter of how lucky we are in the grand cosmic scheme of things, whether one will hit us or whether it'll just miss us by a little bit. And we do know of many, many, many of these objects. We know where they are, and we're aware that just exactly the wrong situation, you could have an impact. And it does matter how big they are. Like a little one, like the one that hit Russia a couple of years ago, That one, the asteroid, is about the size of a school bus. So it blew up, and it blew out windows across much of Russia, and it buried itself in a lake and made a crater. But it wasn't that big, you know, in terms of the scheme of things. The one that killed the dinosaurs was 6 miles in diameter. So,
wow.
You know, it's an asteroid the size of Seattle, basically, coming your way.
Yeah, hopefully not in our time. But
I agree with that. I support that idea.
That's right. So we'd be remiss to get people so excited about all these cool fossils without reminding them of how important it is to follow a certain protocol for their collection, right? Would you please briefly summarize what those are?
I think the main thing is the person who owns, the person or government entity that owns the property owns the fossils. So you shouldn't trespass to collect fossils on somebody's property. You shouldn't collect on federal or state land without knowing what the permits and the rules are about that. And the only way to do that is to talk to your local museum or to your local land manager, whether you're, you know, whether it's the Bureau of Land Management or State of Washington or Washington State Parks. You do need to find out where you can collect fossils. And unfortunately, in Washington, the fossils are present, but they're scattered and rare. I mean, we find fossils almost by happenstance. For instance, they recently found a mammoth tusk at South Lake Union, the construction site. And people don't normally think to go looking at South Lake Union for mammoth tusks, but there was one in a construction site, sort of an accidental discovery. And that's the way most Washington State fossil discoveries happen, is that most people aren't looking for fossils or expecting to see them, but something will happen and there will a fossil will be. There was a great example in the early 60s of a giant ground sloth skeleton that was collected during the installation of a light post at the SeaTac airport runway system. So fossils are kind of like giant gold nuggets. You can think about finding them, but usually the person that finds them is somebody who wasn't looking for them. Somebody just bumps into them.
Somebody that was hoping not to find them because they wanted to build something else.
Probably so, yeah.
Yes. Well, we have once again run out of time. I don't know whether to thank you and Ray for writing this great book or not, because all that I want to do now is take a long road trip to look for fossils. And I'm
our work here is done. This is very good news.
That's right. I'm already mapping out my route for next summer. And you might think that I'm joking, but I am not. I've been taking notes and I'm really excited about it. So thanks so much for joining us on the radio. And thanks so much for all of your work in helping open our eyes to this wonderful new world.
I can assure you it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much as well.
With the holiday season upon us, most of our fine natural history groups are either taking a couple of weeks off or deeply immersed in the annual Audubon Christmas Bird Count. But the Olympic Peninsula chapter of the Audubon Society is still busy.
In addition to their annual bird count, which was held on December 16th, please stay tuned for their results along with those from other counts in the area once they are all tallied. They have a couple of grand events planned for Saturday, December 21st. Please join them at the Dungeness River Audubon Center just outside of Squim for a winter birding field trip from 8:30 to noon, aimed at beginning birders and newcomers to the area. Then, from 10 a.m. to noon, join them in the classroom at the center for a special lecture on coyotes. Please go to OlympicPeninsulaAudubon.org for more details.
And here's our mystery sound again. It's a northern saw-whet owl, one of three species of small owls found in our area. It's named for the supposed resemblance of one of their most common calls to the sound of saw teeth being sharpened. This tooting call is similar to that given by another of our small owls, the pygmy owl, but the pygmy owl call is about 3 times slower in rhythm than the saw-whets. Northern saw-whet owls are small, about the size of my hand, and beautiful. They're chestnut brown owls with prominent white markings on folded wings and brown and white striped chests and bellies. They have no ear tufts, their eyes are yellow, and their white eyebrows connect in a Y over their beaks. The juveniles look a lot different from the adults and are solid brown above with light buffy bellies and a well-defined white triangle on their foreheads. They're strictly nocturnal and hard to see, and are usually tracked down by their calls or by being mobbed by other smaller birds. It seems that their populations have been declining in response to the dramatic increase in the population of barred owls in our area. Barred owls are owls whose range used to be confined to the eastern United States until a few decades ago, and their populations have just been exploding over here in the west. It was apparently a good nesting year for northern saw-whet owls to the north, so be on the lookout for these migratory owls this winter. Owls are quite vocal right now, setting up pairs and territories, so listen for their hoots at night. And that's it for KPTZ's Nature Now for the week of winter solstice. Thanks very much to our guest Kirk Johnson for taking the time out of his crazy schedule to visit with us, and to our sound engineer Nora Petrich for orchestrating it all and helping me share upcoming observations and events. Wishing you all a very happy solstice and holiday season, and as always, the happiest of trails.